Good morning, folks.
Just so you know, Pearl insisted I change the clock at the back so that you're not going to be in for an hour and a half of meditation. Pearl read to you the introduction and what the worship committee had in mind when they asked the question, why did Jesus die? And they wanted the more earthy version of approach to answering that question. So for myself, I changed the wording a little bit, and I hope that's okay with the worship committee. I changed the question to say, what got Jesus killed? Because to me, that sort of addresses that question, I think, a bit more from the approach that the worship committee was looking at approaching it from. Because I was the first one contacted about starting this Lent series, I had the freedom of the choice. And so I read the various passages, and they're all out of Mark. And for some reason or other, this passage spoke to me almost immediately, and I chose this even though this is technically at the end of the passages that refer to the Lent season here that the worship committee is going to be dealing with. But I like this passage. As I say, it spoke to me, and I'm not quite sure why even yet. But it's the passage that has to do with the vineyard. It's the parable of the vineyard. Now, in some Bibles, it's referred to as the parable of the vineyard. In other Bibles, it's referred to as the parable of the bad tenants. But either way, it's the same parable. But before I talk about that parable, I think in order to get the full context of it, we need to put it into context as to why that parable was being shared by Jesus. Now, this parable is found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But worship committee chose to use Mark as the text. But there's certain parts of it that Matthew give a little bit more detail on, and I'm going to refer back to Matthew a couple of times before we get into the Mark passage. We have heard that Jesus has ridden into Jerusalem triumphantly on the donkey. The crowds have gathered, and they witnessed his entry into Jerusalem. We, in Matthew, are told that Jesus went to the temple a couple of times. And the first time that he went into the temple, he did amazing things and he said amazing things. And in response to some of the things he said and did, the children in the temple started to sing Hosanna to the Son of David. Now, the Jewish leaders, as we know, have been following Jesus' actions all along, and they had definitely observed his entry ride into Jerusalem. They were there listening to what Jesus was doing in the temple and how the crowds and the children in this particular instance were responding to him. But they didn't do anything that first day. But Jesus returned the second day to the temple. And this is where the Mark passage picks up and continues the same as the Matthew passage does. So the religious leaders come up to Jesus when he comes into the courtyard. And they ask two questions, and you just heard those two questions being asked. By what authority are you doing this? And the other one is, who gave you the authority? And I'm going to suggest that there were two motives behind the question. The first one, which I consider the genuine motive, and the other one is the ulterior motive. The genuine motive is, I think, the one that you and I would identify with completely. And so we are on the same page, the religious leaders and us. And that is this. Imagine witnessing a person making a blind man see, healing a lame man, and causing him to walk. You hear this man preaching and teaching, and he's saying things that astound and confound the religious leaders. And you are amazed at the depth of his knowledge of what he's talking about. And I think there is this genuine, absolute, profound, how did you do this? How can you possibly do the things you are doing? How can you possibly say the things you are saying? Where did you get this knowledge? Who taught you? And so the question, I think, is a very genuine one of, by what authority? Who gave you this authority? That is, I think you and I would have said the exact same thing. But the ulterior motive is the troubling one. And I'm going to suggest to you that this whole parable talks about gang warfare, turf war. And you say, what? I mean, Jesus isn't a gang. You're right. Religious leaders could be. But it's a sense of, let's just use an example. The Hell's Angels decide to establish Winkler as a base for operating. And when they take over, they are in control. They determine what business takes place and what business isn't allowed. But if I walk in wearing the colors of a desperado or the banditos or the Satan's Choice, there will be a price to pay. There is a consequence because I have entered their territory without permission. Nothing happens in the Hell's Angels territory unless they say so. And me walking in wearing a different set of colors, I am opening the door to conflict. Something is going to happen. And in a sense, this is what Jesus is doing to the Pharisees and the religious leaders. The religious leaders are the ones with authority. They are the ones with power and control. And with power and authority comes privileges and prestige as well. The temple and the Israelite people is the religious leader's domain. We are the ones who are in control. We have the authority. And that you can see that being exercised even when the Romans want to talk to the Israelite people about things. Who do they go to? They go to the religious leaders to discuss things. I don't think they discussed very often. They maybe simply stated that this was going to happen and it's up to you to confer that to the people. But nonetheless, they were the contact point. They were the political contact point. They were the point of contact from the religious context. They were the theologians. They were the ones who were the teachers and the preachers. This was their domain. And Jesus entering in and doing, performing what he was doing and teaching what he was teaching, he had entered their domain. This was a new gang coming in and challenging our authority. And so when they asked that question, they were in a sense asking, who gave you this authority? Who did you talk to? What gave you the right to have this authority on our turf? And it's interesting how Jesus responds. Jesus would have been a fantastic TV politician. He answers a question with a question. And he says, I'll tell you what, I'll answer that question if you answer mine. And it's the question about John the Baptist's baptism, was it? Heavenly or was it earthly of origin? And the religious leaders are in trouble because no matter how they answer, they are in trouble, either with Jesus or with the crowd. And so Jesus says, well, in that case, I'm not answering your question either. And by responding that way, Jesus once again does exactly what the religious leaders were opposed to in the first place. Jesus says, you were trying to take back your control, your authority, by asking me these questions. But by me responding this way, I am showing you that you have challenged God's authority. I am still in control. I will answer the question on my grounds, not on your grounds. You're not in control here. I am. This is God's territory, not your territory. That's my interpretation of how I see that scene kind of working its way out. And with that scene just having happened, we now come to the parable of the vineyard. And this parable of the vineyard is a very simple, straightforward parable, as in it is clear what is being communicated. The people who identify themselves very easily in this parable, it's understood. They understood it. We understand it. It's very simple. There are some characters. Who is the vineyard owner? It's God. Who is the vineyard? It's Israel. Who are the servants? They were the prophets that that God sent. And it may have referred to even John the Baptist. Who are the tenants? It was religious leaders. Who is the son of the vineyard owner? Well, it was Jesus. And who are the others that are referred to at the end of that passage? and it's the Gentiles. And so this is in response to that challenge that took place in the vineyard, in the courtyard. And so to me, this is a parable that challenges the authority of the religious leaders. It is more about the religious leaders than Israel itself. It is about the religious leaders. And Jesus is saying in this story, take a look at what I'm saying here. He says, I sent prophets, and you decided to dispose of them in one form or another. You did not respect them, and you did not honor them. But I thought if I would send my son, you would honor the fact that he was my son. But you are going to, and this is a prediction, actually, because it hasn't happened yet, you are going to dispose of that son. And the reason, and your thinking is this, and I'll just mention, apparently there was a hereditary law, a law of inheritance in Israel at the time, at least according to a commentary I read. In Israel at the time, if the last heir to a piece of property died, the people who possessed that property at the time inherited that property. In other words, in this parable of the vineyard, the tenants were the renters, right? They were the ones who worked the soil, worked the vineyard. So when they said, let's do away with the son of the owner, and then we will inherit the vineyard, it was using that law of possession is 9/10 of the law kind of thing. So by killing the only and sole heir to the vineyard owner, they believed they were going to take possession of the vineyard. And it is that what he is challenging the religious leaders on. And so when he shares this parable, what is he really saying to the vineyard owners? To the religious leaders of the time? The way I see it is, Jesus is challenging, once again, their authority, just like he did in the temple. And he's saying, your inheritance came from Moses and from Aaron. You, the religious leaders, were given the responsibility to be the custodians of the law. It was up to you to hold the law, to uphold the law, to preach it and to teach it, and to encourage your fellow human beings to follow the law. In other words, you were given the responsibility of being the stewards of the law. By what you are wanting to do and how you are responding to my ministry and my actions, you're demonstrating that you have been corrupted. You are no longer the stewards of the law in your eye, but you took on the ownership of the law. And what gives you the right? Who gave you the right to take on the ownership of the law? All along, your responsibility was to be stewards of it, not to claim ownership of it. And so I am challenging, and God is challenging, your authority, not because you have authority and you have power and prestige that goes with that. I don't think he was opposed to that. It is how they claimed. They had usurped or were attempting to usurp the power of God and put it into their own hands. And that is what Jesus was challenging in that parable. And to demonstrate that they were not going to be the owners of that authority, of the law, he says in the end, and what is the owner going to do? He is going to take away this what you claim to own and give it to the Gentiles. And by making that statement, Jesus once again asserts the authority of God over the religious leaders of Israel at that time. That is how I kind of see it and interpret this parable of the vineyard. But when I was working through this, that came fairly nicely to me. And I sort of thought I knew what I wanted to do with it, but I wasn't quite sure how to connect them. And so yesterday when I saw Kelvin, I said, I got these 2 points, but I didn't have the bridge until 2 days ago. At 8:35 in the morning, the bridge came. It feels like a swinging bridge, but I'm going to walk across it anyway. So here goes. What does this passage got to say to us today? And I'm going to say there's three points I want to make about this. One is that this passage, I think, is a wake-up call or a self-evaluation challenge to the church in general. And that is to say, like the religious leaders who went from being the stewards of the law to trying to become the owners of it, I suspect they never called a conference. They didn't do a conference call and said, let's make a decision whether we want to move from being a steward to being an owner. This was maybe a series of small steps, very subtle. They weren't even aware that this transition was happening. But they moved slowly over a course of a long period of time and of thought to the idea that ownership would be better than the stewardship of the gospel. And so my question is, for us here today, is are we stewards of the gospel, or have we taken ownership of the gospel? I look at the church at large, the larger church, and I hear things coming out of the very obvious one, the Catholic Church. I mean, you want to talk about a church that exudes power, that's one of them, right? And then you have all the sexual harassment things or sexual abuse things that have been going on in the church. And they're not alone, but they're the ones up in the spotlight, right? So you look at that setting, or I listen to some of the messages I hear coming from some of our neighbors to the south, some of the fundamentalist thinking, and I'm like, if Jesus were walking in our midst, would he say, when did you take over ownership of this gospel? Has it been diverted and converted and diluted to what it, I can't even recognize it. I gave you the responsibility as a church to be the stewards of. And I think I'm noticing that you're taking ownership of. So the challenge is, how does that relate to you and me here at Covenant? How do we bring it down directly? And I'm going on a limb here. But Covenant is in a new phase. That new phase began a couple of months ago when Kelvin gave us a letter saying that he is resigning. That new phase is called transition. And we will be in this transition phase for a couple of months, maybe a year or so. But we're in this transition phase. And I think it's a good time for us to ask ourselves, what do we want from this church? I've heard Kelvin a numerous times say to me, and I'm not sure whether he said it to me or whether he said it to the congregation, but he said, this is not my church. And Kelvin's right. It isn't now, and it has never been his church. And it was never the founder's church. It wasn't the Gary and Linda's and Don and Joyce's of our congregation's church. It never was their church. It's not your church, and it's sure not my church. This is God's church. And so the question is, are we, as we move forward, as we look at where we are going to be led, are we watching and being careful that we are the stewards of the gospel rather than taking ownership of it? So there is the one question. The other one is, how does power and privilege relate to this story to us here at Covenant? And again, in my mind, I'm being a little bit bold with some of the things I say here. But let me suggest to you that you and I are, in this setting, are all people of power, and we are all people of privilege. When you look at the structure of how covenant is set up, I think we are a little bit unique in some ways in that we are more of a grassroots leadership style than we are a top-down leadership style. And by being that kind of leadership style, that means your voice is as important as my voice, is as important as Kelvin's voice, as anybody else. And we need to hear each other's voices. So how do I exercise that power? Speaking is power. Not speaking is also a form of power. How are we going to exercise it? As we move through this transition period, and we know there's already conversations taking place, what's going to happen next? What's happening now? What's going on? Where are we going from here? Those conversations are taking place and will and ought to, because we need to make decisions and we will need to take actions. And I am convinced that we are going to disagree on a whole bunch of stuff. But we have a chance to use our power to model God in our community. Or we can fall flat. I think when I observe church politics, I've noticed that people tend to observe what happens in churches. And they watch more closely when there is a transition potentially happening, because there is a potential for problems to arise. So is this going to be an opportunity that we take to show our true God calling and respond to each other in speaking the truth in love? Or are we going to fall apart in the differences of opinion that we're going to express and need to express? Are we going to be trying to build the church in my image or in God's image? And the challenge for us is, how are we going to use that power and influence that you carry and that I carry? And the other part is the privilege that goes in with that. And I'll say, that doesn't seem all that noticeable, but if you take the global stand, it is very evident. I'll just use myself as an example. I am a white, heterosexual, able-bodied, middle-class, North American male. Are you hearing privilege anywhere at all? Nah, none? Oh, let me continue. No. And you and I, you have your version of that privilege. And with that comes power, and with that comes responsibility. And so all I'm just tying it back into the power thing. How do you and I choose to exercise that power? And then lastly, I want to leave something with you that I found powerful and I think ties into this morning's meditation for me. This was something that Pearl forwarded from Richard Rohr. And what Richard did in this particular little blurb was he put into his own words points made by a Quaker pastor by the name of Philip Gully in a book that is entitled, If the Church Were Christian. Isn't that kind of an interesting title? If the Church Were Christian. And Richard Rohr's words from Philip Gully's book are this. And I think these might help us in living out the stewardship of the gospel. Jesus is a model for living more than an object of worship. Jesus is a model for living more than an object of worship. Affirming people's potential is more important than reminding them of their brokenness. The work of reconciliation should be valued over making judgments. Gracious behavior is more important than right belief. Yes, Dave? Which one? Okay. Well, I'm not done yet. Let me go through the list here, and then I'll do it. Okay. Inviting questions is more valuable than supplying answers. Encouraging the personal search is more important than group uniformity. Meeting actual needs is more important than maintaining institutions. peacemaking is more important than power. We should care more about love and less about sex. Life in this world is more important than the afterlife. And in brackets, he says, eternity is God's work anyway. And he closes with this statement. If this makes sense to you, then you are already inside of emerging Christianity. And instead of rereading it, I have the list here. I'll make it available to you. Amen.